Welcome back to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we bridge learning gaps and empower families to access the special education services they need. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I'm thrilled to kick off season 3 with you. Our podcast is your go-to resource for special education, offering expert insights, inspiring stories, and actionable tips to help your child thrive. In this season, we'll dive deeper into the world of special education. So whether you're a parent, educator, or passionate advocate, join us in this journey. To make this season unforgettable, please like, listen, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Your support helps us reach more families and create a stronger, more inclusive future. So hit that subscribe button, join our community, and let's make season 3 a game changer. Thanks to listeners like you. Hello and welcome, Dr. Matt, to the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I'm looking forward to our conversation about the neurodivergent playbook. So welcome and thanks for joining us.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I feel like there's a lot you and I are going to talk about.
Right. I always feel that way when we have amazing guests such as yourself, that I feel like I could just sit here for quite some time, but we'll see if we can at least get the highlights for folks that are listening so they know where to find you and get information to get themselves supported. So before we dive in, can you let folks know about who you are and a little bit about your background and what brought you to this place of being a special ed strategist?
Yeah, so my name is Dr. Matt Zakreski. Everybody calls me Dr. Matt. I'm a clinical psychologist and I specialize in working with neurodivergent people. Usually that's giftedness, ADHD, autism, dyslexia. And when I started doing this work, I very quickly realized that the therapy model is helpful. But if you really want to impact change with people with these neurodivergent brains, you've got to impact their systems. So given that I'm primarily a child psychologist, that's meant talking to a lot of schools. But the more schools I talked to, the more that also turned into me talking to like Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and soccer teams and youth groups at churches. And then my kids started to grow up and then I started talking to colleges and then companies. And, you know, we have lots of people who are neurodivergent who have those special education needs. And they don't magically get normal when they turn 18, right? It's a lifelong journey. So, you know, I built myself an advocacy hat and I started wearing it. And, you know, it's become this huge part of what I do. And it's honestly probably my favorite part of my job.
That is awesome. And you're right. I'm in the, you know, pre-K through post-secondary space and supporting our learners and bridging those learning gaps and helping them access special education services. And I like how you said, you know, that 18, when our, you know, up to the 12th grade is done, it's like, oh, okay. And you're off in the world. And so resources are little known. And so providing some resources and direction to families to continue the support that they've been doing with their children is important. Before we hop into some questions here, what is a little known kind of fun fact about you that people may not know?
Ooh, I love it. Little known fun fact about me is that I was very briefly in the movie Dogma by Kevin Smith. I am a person in the background and Ben Affleck pushes me out of the way. So I have no lines and you can see like half of my face, but that's my weird fact claim to fame.
Well, that's super exciting. How did you even get to that place?
Well, so I grew up in New Jersey and Kevin Smith and Jay Muse and the whole View Askew team were anchored in that part of New Jersey. And I used to go to their comic book shop all the time because, you know, professional nerd. And one day I was sitting there and Kevin was like, hey, what are you doing this weekend? And I'm like, I'm 15, nothing. What do you think I'm doing? And he's like, well, come to this church at this time and you can be in the movie. So I showed up and there was a whole set and, you know, you're walking out, it's like, there's Janine Garofalo and Chris Rock and Matt Damon and like all these famous people. And I grabbed myself a crawler at Craft Services and they're like, all right, stand over here. Ben's going to shove you out of the way. Then some stuff's going to happen. You run, everybody runs. And I'm like, okay. And we did that for a little bit. And after about an hour, they were like, all right, we don't need you anymore. And I called my dad. He picked me up and I went to soccer practice, you know?
That's excellent. Excellent. For a 15-year-old, that's like
I mean, that's
huge.
pretty top, right?
I mean, for my age, it would be huge. It would be a lot of fun. So 15 is amazing. I'll take it. Can you explain how giftedness and twice exceptionality are defined in the context of IEP? So I know we kind of just started way ahead of our age span and jumping above 18, but if we could just kind of peel it back a little bit and just talk about how that relates to IEPs.
You know, so gifted education is special education, right? I mean, if we think about it as like tier one, tier two, tier three interventions, just flip that over to the other side of the IQ spectrum, right? If you've got a fourth grader who's doing calculus, that's a tier three intervention, right? We are changing the entire curriculum so this kid can learn what they need to learn. So when I talk to administrators or teachers or principals, the first thing I say is like, you're already doing special education. I just want you to include gifted kids in that party, right? So any individualized education plan is a formalized contract, right? So we're going to teach you differently and we're going to teach you differently in these ways for these reasons. And I'm always a strong advocate for stuff like that because people with different brains tend to learn differently and they tend to need different things. So let's codify that. Let's write it down. Let's have check-ins because there's nothing more dangerous than the, oh, we'll just do that. We don't need to put it in the IEP. And I scream internally. Some states have formal gifted IEPs, Pennsylvania being one of them. So you can get a GIEP. And that's, you know, specifically for that gifted education stuff, really embracing that it is a completely different educational paradigm. And most people are familiar with giftedness as a construct. Where a lot of people don't really follow is where we get into twice exceptionality. So twice exceptional is when you have a gifted IQ and some other sort of brain difference, usually ADHD, autism, dyslexia. So what you have there is a kid who needs the both ends of the IEP support, right? You need the high end, like, okay, you need to do calculus, then we're going to have you do calculus, but also you need 200% time to do tests, and we're going to let you turn in homework 2 days late, and we're going to give you a scribe for your writing class because you have dysgraphia. And there are still people out there who think, like, you can't be gifted and autistic. And I'm like, you actually can. There's a word for it. So we're sort of pushing back on misinformation and explaining that these different brains sometimes co-occur.
We help empower families and parents to take that first step to helping identify their child as twice exceptional. And I say that specifically because there are a lot of schools that give pushback. They'll say, oh, your student's doing fine. Your student's doing great. Your student's above average. Why do we need to provide additional support? So what would be your first kind of information or tip for families to say, okay, wait, I have rights. My child has rights, and helping them through that process.
So if you feel like something's different about your kiddo, then we should absolutely start at the schools to get that assessment process started. And you absolutely, you know, Wendy, you named it, right? I mean, schools will say, like, they're fine. They're getting straight A's. Why would we test that kid? It's like, well, first off, it's my right as a parent to ask for that. You know, you have to consider my request. Unfortunately, this is why a lot of parents of gifted kids end up going private testing somebody like me because they cut the line. You get it done faster. And that's all well and good. But the reality is that somebody like me costs $3,000 for a test, right? I mean, of course, I think it's worth it. I wouldn't charge that if I didn't think it was worth it. But I can't pretend that every family can afford that, right? There's different ways to go about that. But if you have reason to believe your kid's different in any way, right, then the school absolutely should be taking a look at that formally. And if your kid has been diagnosed with a different kind of neurodivergence, so a lot of times kids who get diagnosed with ADHD or autism very young, the school says, well, that's enough. That's all we need. And we're going to get their grades up and we'll be fine. One neurodivergence very much predicts a second or third kinds of neurodivergence. And I can't tell you how many kids are sitting there in special education who are, say, like dyslexic, who are brilliant, but because so much of school is about reading and writing, they look less intelligent. They get treated as less intelligent. The system doesn't let them shine, right? And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if your kiddo has any diagnosed neurodivergence, you should absolutely say it's my right to ask for an IQ test, because IQ is an imperfect measure, but it's also something that can open a lot of doors for your kiddo and give more nuance and complexity to their neurotype. Because I still run into people who say, like, well, autism, aren't those are the kids who can't talk, right? And I'm like, I work with autistic people who are smarter than I'll ever be, right? I mean, the autistic brain and the gifted brain have a lot in common. So when we have these narrow definitions of certain special education markers, then oftentimes that's where the conversation stops. You know, if your kiddo is dyslexic and we get an IQ test, maybe they're gifted and we can access different kinds of supports, or maybe we just learn what their learning style is and their processing speed, and that's good data too. You can't have enough information, because that information allows us to work smarter, not harder.
I agree. And parents that have come to me and asking about testing and what that process is, and I always say just that, you know, it's more information, it's data that we can then make informed decisions and use to access, again, supports and services that may align with the needs of your student. So I always think it's a great idea to kind of see what's going on. What are the criteria, or what criteria are used to identify giftedness in students for an IEP process?
Most schools will use the IQ score of 130. 130 is two standard deviations above the mean. So that's the 98th percentile. That's where we traditionally the marker for giftedness has been. There are some districts who are absolutely hardcore, like it's 130 or don't talk to me. Right. So you get a kid who has a 129, and they're like, sorry, you're not gifted, which to me is absurd. Right. It's like, really? Like 1 point? You know, okay. Right. And this is where we get into some nuanced stuff where, sure, I can report a full scale IQ. I also want to report the General Ability Index, or GAI, that cuts out the impact of processing speed and working memory, things that neurodivergent kids tend to struggle with. I can't tell you how many times I've tested a kid where it's like, oh, their full scale IQ is 123. That kid is very smart, very intelligent. That's about the 93rd percentile. But then you strip out the negative effects of processing speed and working memory, and the kid's IQ is 140. And it's like, okay, this kid is brilliant. They just work really slow. Or this kid is brilliant, but they often forget their homework, right? School, the easiest two accommodations to give in school are more time and executive functioning support, right? Email the homework home. Done. Problem. Yeah. Google Classroom, everybody. Let's, you know, hooray. And so I'll say to districts, I'm like, yes, I know this kid by then. That number doesn't meet your criteria. However, put this kid in the gifted program and have the teacher email the assignments home. And this kid will be a 140 IQ score, because that's actually what their brain is doing. We're just asking them to navigate systems that don't necessarily fit their brain.
What consideration should be taken into account when identifying gifted students who may also have exceptionalities?
What you're likely to see is high highs and low lows. And the problem with high highs and low lows is they tend to cancel each other out. There's a phenomenon in gifted education called the gifted C, because gifted kids who are sitting there in class and they're bored and underwhelmed by the material. So they're looking out the window, they're spinning their pen, they're counting all the dots on the floor. And the teacher's like, well, they're not participating. Zero for today. And then they forget the homework. You know, so zero for today. And then they get the test and the teacher's like, now I'm going to get him. And the kid gets a 98 on the test because they know all the stuff. So what happens if you get 98s on your tests and papers, but zeros on your homework and your class participation? It's up in the middle. You end up getting a 74. And people are like, oh, this kid is a C student. And I'm like, if you pulled apart those numbers a little bit, you'd realize it is much harder to get 98s, 99s on tests and papers than it is to get credit for to turn in homework, right? It's much harder to do that. I want to pay attention to the kid who's getting 99s on things. And if I can help them find a way to turn in their homework, even better, right? So those high highs and low lows. Also, if you see major splits in types of classes. Sort of the easy version of this is like the STEM teachers are like, oh my God, Sally is the greatest student on God's green earth. And the humanities teacher's like, are you kidding me? I would throw Sally out the window if I could, right? Well, that tells me Sally's probably pretty smart. And Sally also might have dyslexia or dysgraphia, right? She might not be someone who handles that stuff well, but you give her a calculator and a workbook and like Sally's going to finish the year by Thursday. So those are sort of some of those markers that we're looking for where the kid just doesn't feel like they fit together. And usually what's driving that is some other exceptionality.
So how do you help navigate this with families in terms of the discrepancy model? Can you explain what that is and how does that come into play in a meeting when they're saying, okay, your student is here, but we don't look, you know, the average is here and they're having a conversation and a parent is listening, but how can we empower them to have the knowledge to be able to speak up and say, yes, that's true, but let's look here?
So the first thing I would always tell you is bring somebody to your meeting, right? Whether it's the psychologist, whether it's an advocate, whether it's a special education lawyer, if you really want to scare them, you know, but the idea is, and I go to a lot of these meetings, 90% of the time, there's 7 to 10 old white dudes in suits on one side of the table and maybe a mom and dad on the other.
I always say it's like a party. I always say that it's like you walk into a party, music's going, people are chit-chatting, and then as soon as you walk in, it's like, bloop.
Yeah, the record scratches. And it was, yeah.
And everybody just looks at you, and it can become very intimidating.
Absolutely. And they, hold on, I'm going to choose my words carefully. I don't think that most schools do this intentionally. I don't think there's any malice. But I think that there is a thing where they know stuff, and they parents probably don't. And they leverage that disconnect to maybe do less, right? And as I've never met a public educator using the singular who doesn't want to do best by kid, never in my career. And I've been doing this for over a decade. Systems tend to fail, right? Because they got to protect the budget. They've got to protect the ego of the teachers. I've had a school psychologist reject my report because he didn't like me very much. And I'm like, listen, this isn't about me. This is about this kid, right? Like, don't like me, fine. Trash me on Facebook. I don't care. Like, but this is a kid who's, you know, he was a third grader and he was working at a college freshman level in science, right? He just got physics. He got chemistry. And I was arguing that we should let this kid move to the high school and do high school labs until he was physically ready to go to college. And this guy's like, Dr. Kressy's wrong. I'm like, well, tell me why I'm wrong. He's like, I just don't like you. Super. Right. So, oh yes. I mean, we could do a whole podcast after hours about this guy. But the idea here is I tell parents three things when we go to these meetings. First is, you can leave at any time. If you don't like it, you can bounce. You can absolutely go because they can't have the meeting without you. Two, don't sign anything until you're comfortable with it. That's an important thing, right? Because once your signature's on that paper, they've got leverage over you. And then three, if they can't explain the concept well enough that you understand it, then they're not doing their job. It is not on you to understand the nuances of educational law. It is on them to explain it to you in a way that is palatable. And having somebody like me on your side can be a translator. It's helpful. You know, sometimes they'll be like jargon, jargon, jargon. I'll say, excuse me, hold on a second. Parents, what they're saying is this. And the parents go, oh. And I say, then we're back, right? So having somebody to bang the drum for you, having someone to help translate, because frankly, in these meetings, I get to be the hired gun. I get to be the jerk, as it were. Because I don't need to maintain a relationship with the district, right? My kids don't go there. Right. You know, that's why I don't take cases from my town, right? But it's like, I will absolutely be the person who pushes the envelope. And they, you know, as I drive away, they're like, this guy, this suit, what a jerk. Cool. Think I'm a jerk. If it gets the kid what they need, I'll be the jerk. You know, yeah. Then the parents get to maintain that relationship. So be aware of your rights. And the good news is that every state has advocacy groups for special education, and the vast majority of states have advocacy groups for gifted education and ADHD and autism. So, oh, and dyslexia, I should throw that in there too. So you want to gather your super friends, right? Captain America can't beat Loki on his own, but when he gets everybody else in on the team, then we've got a chance, right? So you should absolutely talk to the team at, you know, your state's dyslexia association, because they're going to be like, here are the best advocates, here are the best lawyers, here are the best psychologists, here's a support group that meets in the church basement on Thursdays. You should come bring some punch, right? And you're going to realize that you're not alone. And there is something so powerful about realizing that you are one of many, not one of one.
In previous guests, we've talked about that and just the power of finding groups that are in similar situations as you so that you can feel supported. And again, just what you said so wonderfully, just not alone, because when you have a baby and your baby's starting to develop and you realize, okay, I'm not sure what I'm needing to do here to really support my sweet baby, to find others that have been in similar situations so you don't feel like I need to recreate the wheel. And then you can say, okay, this is what's happening. And especially if they're in your area, in your district, and they say, no, you know, this is who you really need to talk to, and this is what needs to take place. And I think it's something beautiful about that community for the support within that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I always say that it's like if you're walking somewhere and you see someone carrying like an obscure book or wearing a t-shirt of like an indie band, and you're like, I know that book. I love that band, right? One of my favorite bands is the band Trampled by Turtles. I love them. It's like a like bluegrass country folk thing. They're awesome, right? And I was in Stillwater, Oklahoma at a conference, and I was walking across Oklahoma State's campus, and this kid was walking the other way with a Trampled by Turtles t-shirt. I saw him, was like, Trampled by Turtles? He was like, Trampled by Turtles? And we were like, high five. And then we kept walking. And that's what it feels like to meet another parent or a professional who gets that. Because you don't need to start at, okay, I know you don't understand my kid. Here's all the 74 things that are different. You skip to the 73rd step because you know they get steps 0 through 72, right? When a parent comes to me and they're like, oh, I'm not sure if my kid is gifted because X, Y, Z. I'm like, that's actually very common. I speak fluent gifted. I can absolutely explain that to you. And if I can't, we'll either explore it together or I'll find somebody who can, right? So much of the burden we feel as parents is feeling you need to reinvent the wheel. You've got to start from scratch every time, and absolutely give yourself permission to work smarter, not harder, and find people who can do some of that lifting for you, because you're going to find that you've got a lot more energy and a lot more stamina and a lot of more spoons to get things done if you've got some people helping you a lot.
Yeah, it's definitely a marathon. Yeah. And I'll say that to parents as well, in terms of, let me see if I can be of help. And if not, I'm going to help you find resources.
Yeah.
Like, just to the point in supporting. But what assessment tools or methods are used to identify giftedness and disabilities in students?
So usually we're going to use the most schools accept the Wechsler measures, the WISC and the WAIS. That's still pretty much industry standard. There are proponents of gifted IQ testing that prefer the Stanford-Binet because it has a higher ceiling, so you can go higher with it. I do run into a lot of kids who get the ceiling effect on the WISC. You know, if you're a 160 IQ 8-year-old, you're very rapidly going to run out of questions. So I have the extended norms because I want to see how high those kids can go. But that's very niche. Most practitioners don't have that. The second thing is you want to definitely get achievement data. So the Woodcock-Johnson is a good one. Wechsler also has an achievement test. The KTEA is a good one. But the idea there is that there is still this misconception that gifted means good in school, right? And I was one of those kids. I was a gifted kid who was good in school. Right? Like, did all the things, got lots of straight A's, Dean's List, hooray, you know. But many gifted kids, based on their neurotypes and their neurodivergences, don't really fit in school very well. So what you can get at with an achievement test is what level this kid is on vis-a-vis their intelligence. And it's an important point because A, it's going to help us argue for a grade skip. You know, if you have an 8-year-old whose their lowest score is they're doing more like a 15-year-old, it's hard not to say to a district, like, listen, I mean, there's a 7-year gap between how old this kid is and what they're performing at. Meet me in the middle here. Let's make this kid a fifth grader and see what happens, right? Because that's good data for that. But also, it's a way to say to a school, like, my kid can learn at the 99.9th percentile, but is functioning academically at like the 73rd percentile. There's nothing wrong with that. But it clearly we're leaving some meat on the bone here. What's going on? And then we can start talking about like tweaking the way we're delivering educational models, doing some differentiation, some acceleration, the in-class teaching strategies that unlock that gifted potential. Because when I see, you know, as a psychologist, when I see a split like that, I'm like, something is amiss. And it's frankly, it's all too easy to blame the kid, right? Well, Johnny's not engaging in school. Okay, is the teachers doing anything to help Johnny engage? Right? Where are the grown-ups? We have the resources. We have the grown-up brains. I mean, I'm not saying Johnny bears no responsibility. He definitely bears some. But who's easier to move? You know, a 51-year-old teacher with a master's degree or a 9-year-old? I mean, that to me, it's a slam dunk, right? So we want to really play to our strengths and put people in positions to be successful.
So you brought up a good point in terms of the extended scales or extended norms. Some districts, I can't say all, may not have access to that. I feel like I'm trying to figure out how the best way to word this question. School psychologists don't always have access to a variety of assessments. So is it something that if a parent's on trying to figure out moving forward with a school assessment versus moving forward with a private assessment, is there a particular question they should ask in terms of what assessments are available and can those assessments really encompass what we're trying to find out as a parent of our student? Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I appreciate you bringing up the question in that way, because there's a piece here where we want to learn as much as we can, but we want to make sure that we are asking the right questions to drive the testing and drive the report. You know, every so often I'll finish a test and like, oh, here are the numbers. Here's how your kid learns. Great. Working with them. Awesome. Like, oh, cool. Are they depressed? And I'm like, well, you never asked me that question. Like, probably. So it's the sort of thing, like, we can always get data where it's worth having those conversations. The role of mental health in learning is definitely there, but it can be very hard to quantify, right? We know that kids who are depressed tend to do worse on processing speed stuff. How much worse, we don't know, right? And when you mentioned before the discrepancy model, most kids who have if your average person had a 113 processing speed score, right? That's above average, right? It's in the 80th percentile. It's a really good number, right? But if your verbal processing is in the 140s, that score of 118 actually meets the discrepancy standard, right? It's more than 1.5 standard deviations away. And no district is going to say, well, that's a deficit. That's a disability because it doesn't meet the criteria. But I'm like, but compared to the highest highs, right? The example I often use here is, Wendy, are you a basketball fan at all?
I am.
Awesome. Oh. Yes. Love it. So Shaquille O'Neal, one of the greatest basketball players of all time, right? Hall of Famer, you know, won an MVP, won multiple championships, right? All that good stuff. Do you remember what he couldn't do? He couldn't shoot free throws. The easy shot in basketball, he couldn't do it, right? Now, his career average is around 60%. It's not great. It's not terrible. It's just, that's where it is. But when you are one of the most dominant basketball players of all time, that difference feels like a deficit, right? And it's absolutely one of those things where when the highs are so high, we don't want to pathologize average, but we do want to say that in comparison to these other things, it's a problem, you know? And that's, it's a challenging conversation to have with schools because they are correct in saying that this isn't, it doesn't meet the criteria for disability. But that's why we're not using the word disability. We're using the word difference, right? Because absolutely, this is a great score, but it does pale in comparison to the other really high scores. And that's where we can argue for accommodations, because it is not a discrepancy model that starts at X and has to go down. It's a discrepancy model that exists anywhere, right? Shaquille O'Neal is a better basketball player than 99.9% of people who've ever lived, and wasn't that great at shooting free throws, right? And both parts of that can be true.
And I think as for families to understand is thinking of the educational impact. And if we're looking at IDEA and saying, okay, does this student qualify under one of the 13 categories? And then if it's yes, then what is that educational impact? So being able to, as a parent, come to the table to say, here's the educational impact, which is what I always say, bell to bell, bus to bus, hallways, transitions, recess, specials, lunchroom, communication, social, everything, so that you can really start to create a picture of the student and their needs to then start to identify how to support them.
I tell you, that idea, that bus to bus thing, yeah, I think I might steal that, because that's awesome.
Yes. Well, it's a picture, right? It's a visual of, okay, my student's going to school. And oftentimes I hear so many, even with students that may not be gifted, but have some sort of learning impact, that the school's like, oh, they're doing fine. They'll catch up. It's okay. Their grades are fine. But then thinking about from the time they get off that bus to the time they get back on and every little step in between, thinking of that educational impact and not only focusing on academics.
Well, and there's a phenomenon here that can be really helpful. It's called the Yerkes-Dodson Law. And basically what that says is that when things are too easy, we don't engage. And when things are too hard, we can't engage. Everybody has an optimal level of anxiety that helps us learn based on whatever skill set we're talking about here, right? So when districts say things like they're doing fine, you know, who wouldn't want to be in a class where they know all the answers, chuckle, chuckle, chuckle noise. It's like, maybe, but we also know they're not engaging, right? We know that they're building bad habits. You know, the kid who can get away with looking out the window for a 40-minute class period and still get an A on the test is not building the life skills we want them to build, right?
Right.
Sooner or later, that bill comes due, and we call that the performance cliff, when school gets harder than kids are smart. And that's a huge problem for the gifted population, because while other kids are learning study skills and how to ask for help and how to take homework knowledge and make it something you study, gifted kids are sailing along, right? And they're not getting meaningful challenge. So all of a sudden in ninth grade, you can't just flip through the book 3 minutes before the test and get an A. Now you have to learn how to study. And by the way, stakes are very high right now. So we're absolutely pushing meaningful challenge. We're pushing accommodation and acceleration, all the things we want our kids to see, because that's the investment in that bell-to-bell model of sending the kid out of that building as a better person, not just a better student.
How do you explain that? You bring up a great point. How do you explain that to parents? Because oftentimes I'll receive a phone call and do an educational profile on a student, and we talk about their child, and the parent's like, I don't know how I missed this for so long, or I feel terrible as a parent because I should have gotten them help. But it really is in line of what you just said, that students have these compensatory skills. They're able to boop, boop, boop. And then at some point, and it usually ends up being for like third grade, sixth grade, ninth grade, or freshman year of college, like those big transition years where the curriculum shifts enough that those skills are not serving their needs. And they kind of just hit this wall of what's next. Have you ever come to that? And then what can you articulate to a parent to say, it's okay, you're here now, let's move, you know, kind of forward and get some skills going?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. As I often say to people, it's like the best time to start something was 10 years ago. The second best time to start something is right now. And that's the, I think, language that is really helpful to reframe that guilt that comes as a parent. How did I miss this? How did I not know? There are lots of reasons you missed it, right? And those reasons are not good or bad. They just are. And it's, you know, I mean, to quote Maya Angelou, right? Do as well as you can until you know better, then do better, right? And
yeah,
I mean, that's foundational to what I do, right? And sometimes intelligence is compensatory and masks things. You know, parents will say, like, I didn't get diagnosed with ADHD until I was in high school because I was smart enough to power through my ADHD until sophomore year, when all of a sudden the amount of independent work and executive functioning necessary to survive as a high school sophomore was too much for my poor prefrontal cortex, right? And my mom's like, how did I miss this? I'm like, I don't think you did. I think A, I didn't want you to see it, so I worked really hard to hide it from you. And B, I was doing fine. And there's something seductive about doing fine, right? As a parent, and frankly, as a mental health professional, when things are going well, it's very tempting to put your feet up because it's like, okay, I deserve a break, and you do. But when things are relatively calm, it's also an opportunity to invest in some proactive skill building, right? To plan for the future, right? You know, when the harvest is done, you don't stop planting plants. You start getting ready for the next planting season, and you have to. So if things are stable with your kid, now's not the time to stop going to therapy. Now's the time to say, okay, what skills do we want to work on that are proactive, that aren't just put this fire out, right? At some point, you want to invest in more fire extinguishers, right? How do we do that? And those questions, right, those asks are important. So if you're a parent and you're new to this, welcome. You got here exactly when you needed to be. And all we can do is move forward from this place.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And it is, you know, as a parent and you're doing this marathon, it can be exhausting. And so to kind of have that little tip that you just gave in the back of your mind of, okay, when the waters are calm, let's think a little bit further. And even when I'm coaching parents for their parent input statement or their vision statement for the IEP, yes, let's think about 6 months from now, a year from now, but let's also think, where do you see your child 3 years from now, 5 years from now? So we can start that process and laying that foundation so that when 3 years comes, we're not going, oh, holy smokes, I should have done X, Y, and Z to get to this point. So building that team and building that community to help you kind of navigate this is incredibly important. There's a part that we really haven't addressed is kind of the social emotional component of our students that are gifted or twice exceptional. What does that look like and how can we support them within the school?
Boy, this is almost, we almost should do this as part two of the podcast. Yes, that was a shameless plug. Absolutely.
Come on back. I love it.
So one of the things we know about neurodivergent people is that they tend to develop asynchronously, right? So if we're going to use gifted as an anchor here, right? There's only so much developmental energy to go around. The gifted brain has a much more cerebral cortex. That's where a lot of our thinking takes place. And since there's a finite number of amount of energy, that energy gets pulled from somewhere, and it tends to be pulled from social and emotional functioning. So what you'll get is a kid who's asynchronous in their development. So you'll have a 10-year-old who's intellectually 17, academically 15, physically 11, but socially and emotionally 8, because they're just, that tends to lag. And so what you'll see is kids deal with that in one of two ways. One is they find adults to talk to. They find peers that are intellectual peers. So you'll see a little gifted kid running around following the teachers because it's like, that's who our person I can talk to. You know, when I was in grad school, I worked at a school and I had a kid who always followed me around at recess. And I was like, you know, like, dude, I'm always happy to talk to you, but don't you want to like play kickball with your friends? And he looks at me, he's like, who else am I going to discuss the GDP with? And I was like, me, I guess I do read The Economist, right? So it's like, sure, let's do that. But also we can't get tricked into assuming things about them based on chronological age, right? You're like, well, an 11-year-old should be able to do this. And an 11-year-old could do that, but maybe not this 11-year-old because their brain doesn't work that way, right? And it's amazing how often people will forget that piece, right? Or they don't know about that piece. But my mentor, Dr. Jean Peterson, was fond of saying, like, every gifted kid is 5 kids, right? Because that's what asynchrony really is. And you get sucked, you can absolutely get swallowed by that. Or you can say, I just need to meet this kid in 5 different places if I'm going to serve their needs. And that's challenging and it takes a lot of communication and a lot of teamwork. But if you level set your expectations based on those five areas of functioning, then you're going to understand that your kid needs a little social support when they're not talking to your elderly neighbor about their petunias. They're going to do a lot better in that environment than they would at minor league at a T-ball, right? Because that's just not how they're wired. But just because they're coming at this from a place of less doesn't mean they can't grow into it and evolve and overcome. It just means we need to be aware of that process and support them through it.
And I think as a parent, if they could, they're going to need to listen to this a couple of times, the whole episode here. But I think as a parent, if you could sit down and identify looking at, you know, the five different humans that you just kind of described there, and in each of those categories, kind of just say, here's our strengths. This is where they do well. This is where pockets of vulnerability, and this is how to best support them. I think that would go such a long way as the committee or your team is building that IEP. Yeah. Because then you can really take that individualized lens that should take place at an IEP meeting and say, okay, here we are, you know, academically, this is how we can support them. Here we are socially and emotionally, and this is how we can support that student. So really teasing that out, because there are folks that will get that student in a hot second. And then there's folks that are going to need a lot of that kind of finessing and communication of, yes, this is what you see, but there's, you know, with any child, right? There's a depth of everything underneath. And so being able to communicate that in a way that an IEP can be written strongly with the proper accommodations and goals.
And you spoke to something beautiful there that I think I want to highlight for a moment. Is having a staff member that gets it is also very seductive. But staff don't fix kids, systems fix kids, right? Because I'll tell you this, if there's one thing we see about gifted educators all over the country is they leave, they go other places, right? The funding gets cut, or they move to a different district, or they get moved up to admin, or so like, you can have an amazing teacher who gets your kid, and that's wonderful, and we should celebrate it. But we want to distill and codify what that teacher's doing so we can transmit that to as many other grownups as we can. And yes, you will probably lose that ness, that spark that person brings to the table. But if you can do these five skills that this teacher does, then what you're doing is you're raising the floor for every other teacher in the district to potentially get your kid and serve your kid and meet your kid where they are.
How do we help the system as a whole if you're coming in as a parent?
I think the biggest thing is you come at this from a place of realistic goals and meeting people where they are. You know, the idea is that most educators want to help your kid and most schools want to do well by your kid. They may not know what they need to know. They may not have the funding to do more, right? So I start every one of these meetings by saying, like, it's like, have you ever seen the show Restaurant Impossible with Robert Irvine?
Yes.
He's like, thank you for having me to your restaurant, right? I'm here to help. Like, and that's what I always say. Thank you for having me to your school. I'm here to help. And I'm not as physically intimidating as Robert Irvine. My biceps are only so big, right? But the idea matters because these meetings can be very contentious. They can have a lot of hurt feelings. And it's like, listen, everybody on this team is giving up their time to help this kid. We're all on Sally's team. We may have some different ways about going about getting what Sally needs, but we're all here to help that. So I thank you for your hard work. I thank you for your dedication and your advocacy. I'm going to present some ideas. We're going to see which ones of these are practical, possible, and painful, right? Because those are the three stages of change, right? We're going to, it's like, oh yeah, practically, we can absolutely give this kid a laptop. That's easy. Possible, so we could probably possibly bring in a tutor. Sure. Painful is we need to talk about what it's going to cost you to send this kid to an out-of-district placement, because despite your best efforts, you can't give this kid what they need. right? But all of those conversations come from a place of, I know you're doing the best you can. I know your heart is in the right place to help this kid. My job is to make that process easier and better for as many of us as we can. And we have to be willing to have that conversation multiple times. I had a supervisor once who said, people need to hear a hard conversation 7 times before they change. So if you're a parent, you're like, oh no, I've got to do this 6 more times. Yeah, you might. But but that's what it takes. And our kids are worth it.
Can you give some examples of successful IEPs that you've seen for gifted and twice exceptional students?
One of the best ones, so I'll use an example for both. So best IEP I ever saw was a kid in a public high school in Pennsylvania. I'm sorry, public middle school in Pennsylvania, that they allowed him to do all of his arts classes at the high school because there was nobody in the middle school who could teach him arts the way he needed to. So music, dance, studio art, and ultimately theater were all taught at the high school. So he hopped on a bus every day and went to those. So that required us to totally change the schedule. He front-loaded all his academics, had lunch with his friends, and then bumped over to the high school to do arts in the afternoon. So that was phase one. Phase two was, this was a kid who learned very quickly and would sit there and look like he was calm, but he was like a duck, like, you know, looks very calm on the surface, but underwater, feet are going crazy. He would be stressing himself out. He's like, I have so much to do, I have so much to do. So once he finished the thing and he turned it in, the teacher would grade it. And if he got an 85 or higher, he could go to the library and do other stuff, right? And so that was just, and that was the thing that some of his teachers had done before, but it wasn't consistent. And every time there was a substitute teacher, they wouldn't let him do it and he would have a bad day. So we codified that. We said, like, yeah, you did it. And we put that number in of 85%, because otherwise he would race through it and get like a 4 and then just to get to the library. So it forced him to do the work, the, you know, the right way. And then the last thing we did was let him benefit from changing the product of what he were assigned. So, you know, this school loved a chapter test. Give me a chapter test. Give me a Scantron, right? We're good for it. He's not a real test guy, right? So schools were like, absolutely. If he wants to write a paper or do a PowerPoint, we're here for it. So all of a sudden he was doing a lot more, writing a lot more papers, and that played to his strengths. He was getting better grades. He was feeling more confident and comfortable. So this was a really nice systemic thing, because it was both high level, putting the thing, place him in the places where he needed to learn the things. It was individual to the, this is a kid who needs to express what he knows in different ways because that's helpful to him. And it was informed of his mental health, because he would sit there and, you know, spin himself into nothingness. But if we gave him a place to burn off that energy, he was fine. So it was that was a really good IEP. I was happy to be a part of that one. In terms of twice exceptionality, there's a kid that I used to work with, and they were out in Missouri. And this was a kid who had a lot of different, he was very, what we call neurospicy, right? He had all the things, right? ADHD, dysgraphia, dyslexia, dyscalculia. I mean, it was just all under there. So what we did is we gave him an option to do every class at the level and depth that he was able to do it that day. Every class was a choice. And so if he was able to do the work, he would just give, you know, he would tap the, it was a streetlight code, right? Red means I can't do it today. I'm going to do it at home. And my parents will hold me accountable for that. Yellow means I can do it, but I need to make some tweaks. And I'll work with my aide to communicate those tweaks to you. And green was, I'm going to do it like you want to do it, right? And so we built everything around this. And that was social. He would tap that at lunch. You're like, today I cannot do lunch today. Cool, but you can eat at the counselor's office, right? Or, and sometimes it was art, or sometimes it was science. And, but it, what it did is it gave everybody a language to communicate with him around how he was feeling, thus his readiness to learn, thus his ability to learn. And I remember their head of school, who was, let's just say, not a fan when I came on board on the case. And then he's like, listen, for what it's worth, you saved this kid. And I could authentically say it wasn't me. I didn't do the work. I'm not boots on the ground. I'm not in Missouri. I'm in New Jersey. You guys did the work. I helped make the plan, right? Yes, I played a part, but this kid embraced it. The teachers embraced it, and the admin supported it, right? That is not what school looks like for 99.9% of kids on this planet. This is what this kid needed. And I'm telling you, like, all of a sudden, we just saw the best version of him all the time. And it was such a treat to watch his silliness come out, his joy come out, his love of learning return. And his parents, who were able to support his learning at home, were like, fewer fights at home too. It's like, it really was one of those cases where everybody won. And I mean, I don't know about you. Actually, I do know this about you, Wendy. That's why we get up in the morning, right? Yeah. That's why we put on the battle armor and we go out there and we fight for our kids. Because if you can fix one kid's life, then it's honestly, I think it's all worth it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And just to be able to have everybody on board with that communication and collaboration is special. And I hope that other teams can work and navigate that as well to truly individualize that support. I know we're running short on time, but we kind of teased out what resources and supports for 18 plus. Again, I think we could just keep talking and talking. Is there any kind of low-hanging fruit that we could share?
The biggest low-hanging fruit, I would say, is so there are two national organizations that support gifted learners, National Association for Gifted Children, which focuses more on like K-12, and SENG, Supporting the Emotional Needs of the Gifted. So if you are a neurodivergent adult, anybody 18 plus, SENG, it would be your first stop for a lot of gifted adult stuff. I'm speaking at their conference this year, and I'm talking about the power of trivia to teach social emotional skills. And I'm doing a session on how neurodivergent people date, right? So that is absolutely something that is inside, outside the classroom, and something that is wholly outside the classroom. But SENG would be my place to direct you, because they have a lot of those resources for gifted adults. And I have several colleagues who do this work, Gordon Smith, Paula Prober, Gail Post. There are just a lot of people who specialize in working with gifted adults will help you craft a life that makes sense for you with your neurodivergence in mind.
As we wind down, what is a question that I did not know enough to ask that I should have asked?
Well, it's not that you didn't ask, we sort of danced around it almost. It's like, well, these kids are so smart. How come they struggle, right? Because you're saying like, they're getting straight A's. Why would we assess this kid, right? The flip side of that question is, why are they struggling in the first place, right? And that's some of those differences of the gifted brain, very emotionally intense, the social asynchrony, right? Those make things harder. But to me, it comes down to this, like, if we use the 130 IQ marker as gifted, right? That's 2% of the population. U.S. Department of Education says it's somewhere between 6 and 10% of kids are gifted, right? So even if we use that number, there just aren't that many of us, right? 70% of adults are neurotypical. 30% are not. So assessment and community and therapy and advocacy are all vital, because at the end of the day, why do we struggle? It's we struggle because we're a zebra trying to live in a horse world, right? Like, horses and zebras look very similar, right? You think, oh, they probably need similar things, and they can get by with similar things, but zebras need some specific things and horses don't. So you may not be a weird horse. You might be a zebra. And there are, you know, places where zebras go that where they feel comfortable and supported. And I would want that for you.
And to follow up, I always ask my guests, if you had a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why?
The one tip is meet your kid where they are, wherever they are. If you have a 6-year-old who can do calculus, then you've got to teach them calculus. If you've got an 11-year-old who can't tie their shoes, then you've got to teach them to tie your shoes. If you've got a 14-year-old who's finished with high school and wants to talk about college, then we need to talk about college, right? I think the biggest trap we fall into as parents is that we have like an idea for our kids in our head. And when they push against those things, sometimes we push back saying, nope, you're going to play high school soccer because that's what kids do. And it's like, Mom, I don't want to do high school soccer. I want to go to college. I want to learn chemistry. And you're like, but this is not what I had in my brain. And it's hard. You may have to mourn that as a parent, but it doesn't mean it's not what we should do.
Fantastic. I really appreciate your time today. I know folks are going to get a lot out of our conversation. So thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And I hope we do this again sometime.
Absolutely, absolutely. You got a deal. Thank you again for tuning into another episode of the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I hope you found today's podcast insightful and valuable. Before we sign off, remember to show your support by liking, sharing, and subscribing to our podcast. Your engagement helps us continue our mission of empowering families and bridging learning gaps in special education. Don't forget to spread the word about the Special Ed Strategist podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues who may benefit from our content. Together, we can make a difference in the lives of children with special needs. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I can't wait to bring you more inspiring content in the future. Until next time, stay informed, stay inspired, and keep making a positive impact. Goodbye for now.